Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Don Cornegus, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is a man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests who appear on STEM Talk.
Hi, Don. Great to be here. Our guest today is Dr. Francisco Gonzalez Lima. He is a professor in the departments of psychology, psychiatry, pharmacology, and toxicology, and the Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Texas at Austin.
So Francisco describes himself as a behavioral neuroscientist. He and his colleagues at the Gonzalez Lima Lab are recognized as world leaders for their research on the relationship between brain energy, metabolism, memory, and neurobehavioral disorders. So we covered a lot of ground in our discussion with Francisco and have divided his interview into two parts. Today's interview focuses on his fascinating background as a youth, as well as his research into Alzheimer's disease and brain metabolic mapping. The second part of our interview covers two interventions that Francisco explored with the aim of protecting people against neurodegeneration: low-dose methylene blue and the application of near-infrared light. And although he has spent most of his academic career at the University of Texas, Francisco has been a visiting neuroscientist in Germany, England, Canada, Spain, and has delivered more than 120 lectures around the world about his brain research. He has also contributed work to more than 300 scientific publications. So much of Francisco's research has focused on transcranial lasers, memory enhancement, neuroprotection, and neurocognitive disorders. Current research in his laboratory focuses on the beneficial neurocognitive and emotional effects of non-invasive human brain stimulation in healthy, aging, and mentally ill populations. This research primarily uses transcranial infrared laser stimulation and multimodal imaging. But before we get to part one of our interview with Francisco, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we're especially appreciative of all the wonderful five-star reviews. As always, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing iTunes, Google, Stitcher, and other podcast apps for the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. As always, if you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the moniker Cradical. The review is titled, A Wealth of Information. It reads, as a medical student with prior graduate training in nutrition and metabolism, this podcast has further enhanced my education through in-depth interviews with world guests. STEM Talk digs into complex issues in a way that appeals to all listeners. These interviews will certainly be helpful in my future practice. Keep up the great work.
Well, thank you, Cradical, and thank you to all of our other STEM Talk listeners who've helped STEM Talk become such a great success.
Okay, and now on to our interview with Dr. Francisco Gonzalez Lima.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Hi, welcome to STEM Talk. I'm your host, Don Cornegus, and joining us today is Francisco Gonzalez Lima. Francisco, welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
And also joining us is Ken Ford.
Hello, Don, and hello, Francisco.
So to get started, Francisco, you were born in Cuba where your father was a veterinarian, but I understand that your family left Cuba when you were around 4 years old. So how did your family end up in Costa Rica from Cuba?
Yes, there was a time where a lot of families left after the revolution that ended up becoming a communist revolution that was backed by the Russians. And my father was lucky. He and three other veterinarians were offered a deal by the Cattlemen Association in Costa Rica because they didn't have veterinarians. And they basically subdivided the small country of Costa Rica in four regions. My father got the western region to take care of the cattle there. It took about 8 months before my mother and my brother and I were able to leave Cuba after my father left in those days. But that's how we ended up in Costa Rica. I'm eternally grateful to that country for opening up their arms and hearts to my family.
When you were 8 years old, the family moved to Venezuela. Now, as a kid, and I guess you were in Venezuela then, I understand that you got into a lot of fights. Is that true?
Yes, I would say that was one of my daily activities. And that was encouraged by, I had a godfather. And as you know, immigrant families sometimes, and especially coming from Cuba, where there was a lot of fear and intimidation, they were very concerned about their children learning to defend themselves and So I was rewarded for becoming engaged in fights. I usually would do it after school, so I will not do any problems at schools.
That's but, wise.
That was an interesting phase. The idea was that I will not fear challenges, and I will move forward and defend myself.
That's a good approach to life. And your father was your role model when you were young, and he was a veterinarian, as we talked about earlier, who used to actually get on his horse in the mornings and ride out to take care of the cattle. And I understand that when you moved to Venezuela, you used to sometimes accompany your father and actually help him out. What did you actually do?
Yes, going with my father, I played to be his assistant, and he would show me the procedures he was doing with the cattle, including some procedures that are somewhat delicate, but it was a progressive apprenticeship that I went with him, and we did a lot of castrations, as you know, little pigs need to be castrated at a young age, and I became sort of an expert at doing that. So I probably castrated hundreds of these little piglets. But there were other procedures that were more challenging, like being able to palpate the internal organs of cattle. You had to get your full arm through their behind with a big glove all the way to your shoulder and sort of work your way out into the different regions. And I remember that was very interesting. And the most challenging things were castrating horses, but there were also surgeries that had to do with injuries. So it was a fascinating experience as a boy to be with my father doing that.
What an incredible experience. And you attended college for 2 years in Venezuela. And because of your family's experience in Cuba, you were very anti-communist and actually became a student leader on campus, which actually eventually led to some difficulties. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, those years in Venezuela, there was a lot of student-led instability at the university campuses. And I remember that there was a very small group of students that they were just coming into the classrooms and interfering with classes. And the result was that classes were essentially suspended on a weekly basis. And there was a movement from the students to try to stop these. And for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, I was elected the student representative, and we collected hundreds of signatures. And then I had to give a presentation, the first one I gave in an assembly. During that meeting, the small minority of pro-communist students who were actually really not the students, they were just residing on campus to promote this extreme agenda, they will chant a number of things among them that they were going to kill me. And they tried to do that. And so, all the way to my home over there. And after that, then my family decided that it was probably better for me to leave the country.
Interesting story. And one can imagine that had to be problematic. Right after high school, you visited New Orleans and Tulane University, and I understand that you happened to be there during Tulane's homecoming weekend. Can you share the story about that visit and how you ended up deciding to go to school at Tulane?
Yes, that was a wonderful experience. I had the opportunity to spend a couple of months after high school in that area of the country. And at the time, I was a good swimmer, so I started training with the university team. And the coach was a Tulane alumnus, and then he took many of us from the team to visit during that wonderful weekend. And I was so impressed by all the happiness and merriness and spirit of companionship that when it got the time to come to the U.S., I told my family, that's where I want to go.
And because your father was a veterinarian, you went to Tulane thinking that you wanted to work with animals. But as a Tulane undergrad, you actually watched one of your professors, Dr. Joan King, dissect a brain in class, which had a major impact on you. So can you talk to our audience about how this led you to join Dr. King's lab and change your directions in terms of what your research interests were?
Yes, this was a really turning point in my life. She dissected a human brain. This was her first year as a professor there. She was actually an instructor. This was such an interesting professor that I became fascinated with her. Actually, tell you that I fell in love with her and because of her intellectual qualities. At the time, then, I was given the opportunity to do an honors thesis project, and I chose to work in her lab that was chaired by several other faculty members, including the chair of the department at the time. And this was my inspiration from there on.
You earned bachelor's degrees in biology and psychology while at Tulane. What led you to decide on those specific majors? Looking back at it, they make perfect sense for you. But at the time, what pulled it together for you?
Well, at the beginning, I was really interested in biology, and so I enrolled. There was a track called the cell and molecular biology track, and that was the track that I enrolled, and I completed that BS program, but I actually finished ahead of time, so I decided that I could stay for another year and pursue psychology because of my experience. The course where they show the human brain was a physiological psychology course, and so I became very intrigued by this interface between biology and psychology. And in those days, there were no majors that integrated this interest. Nowadays, we have majors in neuroscience or neurobiology that perhaps would accomplish some of that, but the possibility was to do that last year and continue all the way to the summer, starting the summer and then in the following summer. And I remember I was told by the advisors that there was no way that I could complete a major in such a short amount of time. And I just told them, please give me the opportunity to try. And if I failed, they wouldn't lose anything. And of course, that didn't happen.
And you were talking about, you know, back in the day, so you were at Tulane in the early and mid-70s, just for reference for our audience. So during your last summer at Tulane, you worked in the neuroendocrinology lab of Dr. Andrew Challey, who actually later that year earned a Nobel Prize, which must have been incredibly exciting. So can you tell us about the work that you did with that lab?
Yes, Dr. Challey's lab was one that specialized in neuroendocrinology, which was a new field. This was a field of finding out these hormones that were present in the brain, primarily in the hypothalamus, this small area of the brain that is very close to the pituitary gland. His lab was the one discovering many of these so-called hypothalamic hormones or releasing hormones. So I had the opportunity to work there for that summer, and it was a fascinating experience. I saw how a lab of that level operated, and I didn't realize the impact that that work was going to have. So probably I should have stayed behind and continue my studies there at that lab.
I think you did pretty well, but still sounds very interesting. You had decided to pursue a research career after you graduated, and you were thinking about continuing your studies at Tulane. So I'm curious, what brought you to the University of Puerto Rico to pursue your doctorate in anatomy and neurobiology?
Well, while at Tulane, I met a young woman who was from Puerto Rico, and she was admitted to the medical degree program in Puerto Rico, actually before she finished her bachelor's degree, was a very good student. So I decided to visit her over the winter break. And while I was there, there was an activity for the new medical students, and I met a former Tulane professor who happened to be appointed the new associate dean for the and director of the graduate program at the Medical Sciences Campus in San Juan, Puerto Rico. And after talking to him during this activity, I will always remember his words. His name was Dr. Sven Everson. And Dr. Everson told me, "You are a tiger. You're the ones that we want to recruit for this new program." And of course, I had this other reason for being there in Puerto Rico. And so I became the first PhD student in that program. It was a program primarily in neurobiology. Later on, changed the name, or I changed the concentration so I could have like a double major in anatomy and neurobiology.
Create your own path. I like it. And it was in Puerto Rico where you started learning about electrophysiology. So what kind of impact did that have on you?
Oh, this was a very important part of my formation as a scientist. I had the privilege to be in the electrophysiology lab that it was called in those days, Laboratory of Neurobiology, directed by José del Castillo. And José del Castillo was probably the most prominent neurophysiologist of his time. Del Castillo and Cass did some of the seminal work on understanding synaptic communication and the quantum release of transmitters. And in fact, Dr. Cass won the Nobel Prize for this work that he did together with Del Castillo. So I think I was the last graduate student from San Juan who had Professor Del Castillo as a member of a dissertation committee. Mm.
At the age of 24, before you even finished defending your doctoral dissertation, something interesting happened. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. For example, Dr. Sven Everson was recruited from San Juan to be part of the new faculty of a new medical school in Ponce, Puerto Rico. This is in the southern part of the island. At the time, it was created by the Catholic University of Puerto Rico. This private school needed new faculty, and since they were familiar with me, I actually moved very quickly through the doctoral program. I finished in 3 years, so they, before I finished, offered me a position as a new assistant professor, and they were ready there while I was defending my doctoral dissertation with the contract as soon as it was over for me to sign on.
That's a great setup. So Dr. Walter Steele, who is the director of the anatomy department at Ponce, became your mentor and also a collaborator of yours. Can you talk to us a little bit about the influence that he had on you and the papers that the two of you published in the European Journal of Pharmacology?
Yes, Dr. Walter Steele was an inspiration to all of the students, not only the graduate students, but the medical students. And he was one of the oldest at the time, but wiser professors that I have ever encountered. And I, as you can see, was exposed to a very talented faculty. It was under him, while I was teaching, that I actually learned in depth these various subjects that had to do with anatomy. In that process, then we started to collaborate in my lab, and we started doing original work, and this led to my first international publications that were in that European Journal of Pharmacology.
That's fantastic. So in 1981, you met Dr. Henning Scheisch, who was a German professor who had done a study involving the newly developed 2-deoxyglucose autoradiographic method. Can you talk about why this neuroimaging approach to the brain research just absolutely fascinated you, and what led you to propose an ambitious collaborative research project with Dr. Scheisch?
Yes, this was a fortuitous and a wonderful opportunity. Professor Scheisch was there doing a collaboration with Professor Everson. This involved work at the Primate Research Center in the Caribbean. And basically, I became their assistant, helping them out, solving problems, and making possible that they would do the project during the period. And in that process, I learned more about what they were doing and started reading their work. And at the end of the project, before they left, they say, we really would like to sponsor you and invite you to do postdoctoral research work in Germany as a member of one of these organizations that can sponsor international scientists.
So even after returning to Puerto Rico, you continue to visit Germany and collaborate with Dr. Scheisch. And the two of you pioneered studies in animals using a brain marker that's known as fluorodeoxyglucose, or FDG, that contributed to developing the FDG neuroimaging method in humans using PET scans or positron emission tomography. This was the first functional imaging technique in humans, so incredibly exciting and incredibly impactful to the research field and the medical field. Can you talk about this work on the FDG PET as well as the significance of it?
While I was in Germany, this was a period that I was funded as a Alexander von Humboldt Research Fellow, which is a program that gives you a lot of flexibility and opportunity to experiment and take risks. And so one of the things that I did in that group was change the 2-deoxyglucose method into what later on became known as the FDG method. Essentially, the oxygen that was removed from the deoxyglucose we replaced with a fluorine, and we made other changes so that the molecule was a better tracer and a better glucose analog. because of these properties, then this DFDG method was the one that was used to translate into humans using PET. And so essentially what we did was the work of developing the technique using animals and animal brains, and this made it possible then to move into human neuroimaging from a functional point of view.
Speaking of the functional point of view, it might be good here to share with our listeners the difference between functional studies and classic imaging studies.
Yes, the difference is that the imaging studies focus on the structure of the brain, if you will, the anatomy of the brain, or some other part of the body. The functional studies, what you're mapping is some kind of activity that you're measuring, for example, in the nervous system, which was the primary focus in at the beginning of these studies. And with the case of FDG, the brain primary fuel is glucose. So when neurons are more active in response to a stimulation or a brain operation, they will take more. So FDG uptake became a signal that you could use to monitor where activity was happening. And that's what we refer to as a functional imaging or functional neuroimaging.
As an aside, one of my first earliest funded AI projects was developing a diagnostic expert system for first pass functional imaging of the heart. I found it fascinating, the whole aspect of a functional study at the time. This was probably like mid-80s. Mm.
So I understand that you were at a conference in Madrid and you met a group of Texas professors. How did that lead you to joining the new College of Medicine at Texas A&M?
Well, I was in Germany. I attended a conference that was called the Cajal Conference on Neurobiology. It was a celebration, or at least commemoration, of 50 years after the death of Santiago Ramón y Cajal. Santiago Ramón y Cajal is the Spanish neuroscientist who is regarded as the founding father of modern neuroscience. So at that conference that was in southern Spain, there were professors and scientists from all over the world, and I was presenting my work with FDG autoradiography, the work that I was doing at the time. And these Texas professors were very impressed by that work, and some of them even joked that, who knows, you may be the new Cajal. So at the time, I was going back to Puerto Rico, started a process of getting in contact with them, and eventually was recruited to that new College of Medicine at Texas A&M University.
In 1991, the University of Texas at Austin recruited you to join its new Institute for Neuroscience and the Department of Psychology. You must like it in Texas, as you've been there for nearly three decades now. Have you taken a real liking to Texas?
Yes, I think most of my career has been in Texas. I regard myself as a latecomer here, but like they say here, I wasn't born here, but I came here as soon as I could. I would say the University of Texas at Austin provided a wonderful environment for me to develop my research career. Unfortunately, places in Latin America where I was before were not an option for me. So I'm still here, and yes, next year will be 30 years of teaching at UT Austin.
Well, congratulations.
Right, absolutely. So this is probably a good time for us to talk about the research that you and your colleagues are doing in the Gonzalez Lima Lab. But before we discuss some topics in detail, can you provide a brief high-level description of the mission of the lab and the work that you and your colleagues are doing?
Our lab has a primary mission is to try to understand how brain energy metabolism is related to behavioral functions, in particular learning and memory functions that demand a lot of energy from the brain, and use that information to translate for new interventions to try to address neurobehavioral problems.
You describe yourself as a behavioral neuroscientist. Can you give listeners a sense of what you mean by that?
Yes, it's important. The field of neuroscience, study of the nervous system, has developed extensively. during the period of my scientific career, even though that I have used tools at multiple levels of analysis, from molecular to cellular to systems to behavioral, it is important that the main questions and the goals of my research has always been oriented towards that relationship between psychology and biology. So behavioral neuroscientist is really the current name that is given to the kind of program that I have been developing throughout my career of interfacing psychology and biology. Another name is psychobiology. They are similar, but behavioral neuroscience, there is an emphasis that the primary questions are questions of behavioral interest.
And on that note, you are often credited with the starting of a revolution in brain metabolic mapping of learning functions. And you published the first neuroimaging studies of Pavlovian conditioning, as well as behavioral habituation and sensitization. So let's first talk about the neuroimaging studies of Pavlovian conditioning. Can you talk about that work and the significance of that work?
In the early phases of the use of this metabolic mapping technique, we realized that this approach was superior to electrophysiology, what I've been using as a graduate student, to provide maps of functional maps throughout the brain. And of course, I was interested in maps that reflected behavioral functions, and in particular, learning functions. And so we started out with the most fundamental type of associative learning, referred to as Pavlovian conditioning. This is the type of learning where a stimulus becomes a signal for an event that follows. So what you're trying to map is what happens in the brain that creates this predictive relationship between the stimulus and the anticipated event, as opposed to the effect of the stimulus itself, or the effects that have to do with the responses of the animal to the stimulus. This also is a paradigm that can be very well controlled. The experimenter has overall control of the stimuli to the animal. And you can also have control groups where are receiving the same types of stimulation. For example, it can be a sound followed by a reward stimulus. However, in some cases, you can do it in a randomized way where there's no predictive relationship between the sound signal and what follows. And in other cases, you can do it in a way that is predictive. And so this allows you to control for all of these effects in the brain and sort of dissect out what are the associative effects from the other changes that are happening due to the various stimuli involved.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience. Can you also give us an overview of the work that you did on behavioral habituation and sensitization?
Yes, I actually first did the sensitization work, and I sort of combined some of the techniques that I use in electrophysiology by directly stimulating inside the brain. So we did what nowadays they refer to as deep brain stimulation. We stimulated in the midbrain reticular formation, and this produces an increase in arousal in animals, and they can be sensitized to have an increased response to other stimuli. These allow us to map what happens in the brain when the stimulus results in sensitization, when the animal is aroused. This type of study then motivated some German colleagues for another German institution to try to come and do some work with me in Texas. And I actually spent also a summer over there, this was at the University of Kassel, to try to study the sort of opposite behavior phenomenon, the phenomenon of behavioral habituation, where an innocuous stimulus like a sound may produce an initial response, but after repeated presentations, the animal becomes habituated and decrease the responses. However, I have to make clear that behavioral habituation, even though it's the simplest form of learning, it is indeed a form of learning and not just simply fatigue. If you, for example, present another stimulus to the animals or a different type of sound, the animal will show a reaction again. So In fact, the brain has to be able to learn that that stimulus is not leading to any negative consequences. And then when you present the stimulus again, it has to be able to have a representation to compare the different stimuli and decide an output. And this output, in the case of a reflex, is, for example, inhibiting defensive type of reflex that you may have to a loud sound. So it actually, behavioral habituation of reflexes involves active inhibitory processes as opposed to decrements in the nervous activity.
Mm-hmm. The brain is designed to handle large amounts of both communication and computation. Can you elaborate a little on how the brain does this, and in particular, the computational element?
Yes. One of the things that we learn when we do these functional maps is that there are multiple systems that are cooperating and working together to produce a particular learned response that is not the result of one single region of the brain, much less a particular pathway, which is not the same as the reductionistic approach that has been used in most of biological studies. In other words, the brain starts out with individual responses, but it has to communicate and integrate these into what I refer to as computational maps. These are maps, for example, that the information is not just spatially segregated, but in which a computation done by multiple groups of neurons produces a readout, an output, that is now the one that guides the response of a subsequent layer of neurons and all the way to a behavioral response.
Much of our anatomy displays a high degree of redundancy. At an obvious level, you know, it's obvious we have two arms and two legs and two eyes. However, the brain also depends on substantial redundancy of a different and less obvious kind. Can you talk about redundancy in the brain and its function?
Yes. As you pointed out, all of our anatomy is characterized by redundancy. So one of the principles I learned studying anatomy is that if the more important a particular function is, the more redundancy there will be to accomplish it. In the case of the brain, we don't have, for example, one visual pathway or one auditory pathway. We have many parallel visual pathways, auditory pathways, and so on. So the information is traveling in parallel. And one of the things that can happen, for example, is that some of the pathways could be more direct. That is, there are less number of synapses between them. In the case of a sensory ascending pathway, as the information goes from the periphery to the central part of the nervous system and then to the cerebral cortex. However, there are other parallel pathways, and these could be more indirect. And in fact, if you have five parallel pathways or six, you're going to have five different sets of direct and indirect pathways. And then it's important that these pathways at some levels converge. So whatever computations are done at lower levels are compared to computations done at a higher level. And there is a kind of a mechanism that you can think of as coincidence detection, in which multiple pathways sort of verify. And if that convergence happens, then information is moved to another level. One analogy that I give to my students to explain this phenomenon, for example, is when NASA here in Texas was coordinating the landing in the moon, they will have 20 different computers doing the same computations. And then they will compare the outputs from the many computers, and only the coincidence results, those were the ones that were deemed to be the actual results. And the brain does similar kinds of operations.
It's fascinating. It's easy to understand why you became so interested in the brain. And I'm saying that from a biased perspective, because I know Ken and I are both just as interested as well. It's such a fascinating and really complex organ. And there's still so much that we don't know about the brain. For example, Alzheimer's disease, which plagues us all and is not at all well understood. Can you expand a little bit about, you know, what your thoughts are as far, and we're going to dig into this a little bit more, but just as far as, you know, that gap between what we think we know with Alzheimer's and what the gaps are and what we're trying to figure out.
Well, unfortunately, the research on Alzheimer's disease is the most unsuccessful example I can think of neuroscience research during my decades of research. And It is unique in the sense that this research has been guided by a pathological consequence, something that you can see, for example, in a postmortem brain, a brain after death. And the idea that what you see there is causal, responsible for the changes that are happening probably decades earlier, has been the major problem. So Alzheimer's disease researchers became dominated by a dogma.
Mm-hmm.
And this dogma has to do with the so-called senile plaques and neurofibrillary tangles, who were deemed to cause the disease. And as long as that idea is pursued, there's not going to be any benefit, because the truth is that that's not what's happening.
I wholeheartedly agree with you on that. Ken and I are both sitting here nodding our heads. And you published a paper in 2001 titled Energy Hypometabolism in Posterior Cingulate Cortex of Alzheimer's Patients, Superficial Laminar Cytochrome Oxidase Associated with Disease Duration. In terms of the work that you've done related to Alzheimer's research, this is the paper that has received the most attention and also set up most of the research that you've done since. So can you give our audience an overview of the study and its significance?
Yes, this is a study that was interesting in many ways, and probably I couldn't do anymore. Yeah, at that time, I tried to look for where could I go to get fresh brains from people with Alzheimer's disease immediately after they die, so I could do, I refer to as histochemical or biochemical procedures with a tissue that hasn't deteriorated. You couldn't do this with the so-called brain banks that are available in the U.S. and other parts of the world, because the tissue has been collected for hours or sometimes days after the person passes away. So I was able to find a place called Sun City, Arizona. And in this city, for retired people that have their own healthcare system, and in that healthcare system, there was a research building who was interested in diseases like Alzheimer's. And I contacted these colleagues over there, and through a number of arrangements, then I spent months over there essentially waiting for individuals to pass out to quickly use a saw and cut off the head and remove the brains, and I will dissect the brains and then freeze them. And the deal that I have with them is that I will cut a piece from every region. I dissected the brain and label all the regions, and from every region I will give a piece to them, and I will save a piece for my lab. All of these will be frozen, and I also took advantage of their control brains that were frozen, did the same procedure, and chipped all of these. I was there with one of my graduate students doing his dissertation on this work, and I think we stay at the same hotel. I don't think that this would be possible anymore to share so close together this effort. So we developed a profile of what was happening in the brain. And the key finding was that this enzyme called cytochrome oxidase or cytochrome C oxidase, which is a respiratory enzyme, the enzyme responsible for using oxygen in a process that leads to energy production in the brain, was inhibited in the brain of Alzheimer's patients. This is what we mean by energy hypometabolism. And in particular, this was happening in the posterior cingulate cortex. There was a general hypometabolism in the brain, but it was two or three times greater in the posterior cingulate. And not only that, in the different layers of this cortex, it was the superficial layers, the ones that show the largest decrease or inhibition of the enzyme. And this was linearly related. The longer the people have being diagnosed with dementia, the more they have this deficiency. And it was not due to a protein deficiency. There was the same amount of protein for cytochrome oxidase. It had to do with what is called a catalytic inhibition of the enzyme. In other words, the enzyme is there but cannot operate properly. And of course, the amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles bear no relationship to the regions that were affected by this, or to the duration of the disease, or any other variable, the disease severity, that you could learn from these patients. So from there on, I had directed my research to learn more about cytochrome oxidase and find a way to upregulate or stimulate this enzyme as a potential intervention for Alzheimer's disease or any other type of compromise of energy metabolism in the brain.
That's fascinating. And when thinking about brain energy metabolism, is the ketone uptake in the brain also diminished in the case of Alzheimer's and TBI, or does it remain as it was prior to disease?
No, it remains. So this is a very good observation. One of the things you remember that with the FDG method, the fluorodeoxyglucose, we could map the uptake of glucose. Definitely the uptake of glucose decreases in the brain. The older brains, and more so the brains of individuals with dementia, have an inability to uptake glucose. However, the ability to use ketone bodies to obtain energy remains similar to what their younger years are. Suggesting that you could use ketones as a way to compensate for the problem of not being able to take up glucose. This is a very significant issue because as people grow older, the brain is not getting their preferred fuel, the glucose, and people may start consuming more sugars and carbohydrates in order to obtain this that the brain is being starved of. And of course, as they consume more of these sugars, then they create a chronic situation of release of insulin. And over time, then the receptors for insulin are no longer responsive. They become resistant to the insulin. And therefore, people develop a type of diabetes that it is they are consuming more glucose, but they cannot take it up to the brain, especially, which is the primary customer or consumer of glucose.
Stephen Cunane, who was on an earlier episode of STEM Talk, is doing some imaging research in Canada where they're looking at whether they're able to replace the amount of energy lost due to the diminished glucose metabolism with exogenous ketone esters. And it strikes me as quite interesting.
Yes, I think it's a promising approach. The difficulty is to find the right ketones that are going to get passed into the brain and that there will be at the right concentrations that will make a difference. But our body is able to use ketones, and we do that every night if we spend enough time between dinner and the following day breakfast. If we spend 14 hours or more without eating, we start consuming some of these ketones during that fasting period.
Yes, I think that's the mechanism of advantage for many of the more subtle effects that one sees with intermittent fasting. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Alzheimer's disease, could you talk a little bit about what are some of the earliest signs, manifestations of this disease? Everyone's concerned about it, and people are often struggling to differentiate changes associated with normal aging from changes associated with various disease states.
Yes. Well, the number one risk factor for Alzheimer's or all of these dementias that I refer to as geriatric dementia, it's, of course, how old you are. So the older you are, the more likely that you're going to have a situation that we call dementia. But there are two ways to approach this. There are early signs, could be regarded as behavioral, and there are also early signs that can be viewed in terms of brain energy metabolism. For example, individuals who have a risk factor called the APOE4 alleles in their 20s, before they have any behavioral change, they already have a posterior cingulate cortex that is hypometabolic with respect to compatible individuals that do not have this risk factor. So already changes are happening decades before we can call it a disease. However, it is very difficult to compare across people to determine when a significant cognitive impairment is happening as compared to the general population of older individuals. So usually primary caregivers or the individual themselves are the ones that are noticing this decline. However, I would say they shouldn't be concerned about this in terms of being afraid of getting Alzheimer's disease, in the sense that the large epidemiological studies with thousands of individuals done in Scandinavia, where they can have access to medical records and cognitive testing, show that already in the decade between 45 and 55 years of age, the memory and other cognitive functions of individuals are significantly diminished with respect to the previous decade. So this is a part of an aging process. And the issue is, if you reach levels that interfere with your activities of daily living, and you can no longer become or be an independent individual. I think this is the main problem. I don't believe that when you are demented is the right time to try to do these interventions. I believe it's as soon as you reach middle age and start seeing cognitive decline. In a way, it is a lifelong lifestyle approach that you need to have in order to preserve this metabolic activity in the brain.
Makes perfect sense. Can you explain the vascular hypotheses with respect to Alzheimer's disease? You know, you mentioned earlier tau and the dominant perspective there. Could you talk about the vascular hypotheses?
Yes, the vascular hypothesis is one of the competing hypotheses. There is a book written by Dr. Jack De La Torre called Alzheimer's Turning Point, where all the evidence is laid out for the vascular hypothesis. One of the things that I mentioned is that cytochrome oxidase is inhibited, that we have less energy in the brain. But the question is, why is that happening? You know, is there anything that is leading to this hypometabolic state? And one of the possibilities is that you have a decrease in the amount of oxygenated blood that is perfused to your brain, the so-called chronic hypoperfusion that happens as we grow older. So the vascular hypothesis focuses on that chronic hypoperfusion, as opposed to occlusion of a particular specific vessel or a more acute event, and argues that because of this decreasing oxygenation and energy production, particularly your mitochondria start developing changes, the so-called free radical changes or oxidative damage. And mitochondria within neurons and neurons within an organism are really important markers of overall aging of that organism. For example, our neurons, for the most part, with two sections in the brain, are the same ones that we have when we were born. So, and within those neurons, we have the largest numbers and volumes of mitochondria because of the high energy demand. But those mitochondria, when they become defective, they divide to sort of regenerate. As a function of time, we have different pools of mitochondria, and the ones that have more deficits then divide at a faster rate than the ones that are healthier. So over time, you start accumulating more and more of the defective mitochondria. And this is oftentimes referred to as the mitochondrial theory of aging. Because of this, you're going to die at some point when your neurons can no longer generate their own energy through mitochondria. The vascular hypothesis fits in all of this, has precipitating this chain of events, that is the decrement in oxygenation that leads to less energy production, and then the oxidative damage that follows as a consequence.
So there's been a lot of coverage in the media recently about early onset Alzheimer's disease, and you've pointed out in past interviews that early onset Alzheimer's disease is a rare genetic disease that is causally different than the most common geriatric dementia that is actually mistakenly called Alzheimer's or late onset Alzheimer's disease. Can you talk about how this confusion has been a major obstacle to advancing research?
Yes, is called early onset Alzheimer's disease, the one that is related to rare genetic abnormalities, it's something that happens in the early 50s or 40 years of age. It's not what is happening in geriatric patients, people with 65 and older years of age. The problem started in the history of science. At the beginning, what we call now Alzheimer's disease was referred to primarily as senile dementia, something that was recognized as happening when people became very old. However, there was a scientist in Berlin, a German scientist, who described a patient that was 50 years old who showed a similar type of dementia. When he looked at the brain, he saw these plaques and tangles, and then describe this as a disease, obviously not related to the senile dementia, because this was not a geriatric patient. And the leader of his group at the time, these plaques and tangles have been described by another team that worked in the present-day Czech Republic, but his last name was Oscar Fischer. And Oscar Fischer has been describing his senile dementia changes. And there was a competition between this team and the leader of the Berlin team, which is Dr. Krepling, regarded as the founding father of psychiatry, wrote the first textbook of psychiatry. And then he say in that textbook, what is happening in these senile dementia patients is not really senility or the result of this mechanisms that are happening as a consequence of old age, but is this all the disease that was described by Alzheimer's, and then the name Alzheimer's disease. Two bad things happened there. One, they took the credit away from Oscar Fischer for describing these geriatric forms of dementia. And two, that they mistakenly say the early onset disease is the same what is happening in the older people. Mm-hmm. And to this date, that has remained that confounded. And of course, these rare genetic disorders, which is not only, it's not actually one, it has multiple chromosomes, multiple genes involved. So it's just about anything that can cause neurons to malfunction to the degree that they start degenerating, that can lead to something that looks like early onset dementia. Dementia refers to the brain having sustained enough damage that it cannot make sense of reality. So there could be all kinds of insults that can result into this. And unfortunately, as in my own case, you know, I started out in cell and molecular biology. There was a revolution in biology and emphasis in that level of analysis. So the hope has been for decades that we were going to find the solution by looking at these rare genetic disorders, and that that solution was going to be the same as what was happening in the geriatric population. And that's not the case.
Maybe the geriatric form should be referred to as something like Fischer's disease. Yes. Is that how you pronounce the gentleman's name?
Yes, Oscar Fischer. Unfortunately, in neurology, there is another disease called Fischer's disease.
Oh.
But I think one could call it Fischer's geriatric dementia.
Mm.
I have a benefactor who is actually very interested in the history of dementia. The fund that he is created to support my work on this is named after Oscar Fischer.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, fantastic.
STEM Talk.
Francisco's had a fascinating career in life, and like he said, he certainly is a survivor. And in terms of his research, he and his colleagues at Texas are doing such a great job shedding new light on ways to deal with a multitude of brain disorders, including age-related brain disease. I think listeners will find part two of our interview with Francisco particularly fascinating. We get to talk to him about two interventions that he's been exploring with the aim of protecting people against neurodegeneration. We get to talk to him about low-dose methylene blue and also the application of near-infrared light. If you enjoyed part one of our interview with Francisco as much as Ken and I did, we invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes. STEMtalk.us. This is Don Carnegie signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.